This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Andy Robbins, sitting in for Gordon Evans. Coming up, Earlene McMichael speaks with Corey Harbaugh, a member of the Governor's Council on Genocide and Holocaust Education, about a new law that requires Michigan schools to teach students about genocide. But first, the Kalamazoo Public Schools and the Kalamazoo Public Library are expanding their efforts to promote reading and head off the so-called summer slide. I asked Kalamazoo School Superintendent Michael Rice to explain just what the summer slide is.
If kids don't read during the summer, they suffer a decline in their reading levels. If you read during the summer, your reading level continues to increase. If you don't, your reading level is likely to drop off. We have a long summer for our schools as a rule. And if you're not reading, that's an issue. If you are, and typically that's through the Kalamazoo Public Library, you benefit. We have a program of sending books home to children going into third, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade during the summer, seven books of their choosing at roughly their grade levels in their areas of interest. One is an all-district read for the given grade level in question. In all, we send about 32,000 books home in the summer for those four grades. Kids get them every week or week and a half. They read the books, send in postcards to our teachers. Our teachers respond to them, challenging to them to continue to read, keep up the good work, keep driving those reading levels. This is based on Professor James Kim's research about beating back the summer slide.
And you're seeing actual, you know, tangible traction as a result of this over the years?
We do. You know, we had the Upjohn Institute evaluate this when we first put the program in place. The Upjohn Institute helped us explore how to best structure the program, again, based on Professor James Kim's research. And after exploring a couple of riffs off of Professor Kim's research, we chose particular grades. And we chose to implement the program in a particular way. But yeah, it has a several month effect on reading levels. And when you think about it, it doesn't sound like that big a deal to have a 4 month effect on reading levels. But that's for one summer. So if you think about that, you do that three summers in a row, and you've preserved a year's worth of reading. Rather than declining by a couple of months, you're flat to increasing rather than declining. And that 4 months, when added up over a period of years, is a real big deal.
Do you think it's a key part of this that the kids who get the books sent to them at home, that they get the books that they picked rather than the teacher saying, you must read this book?
Absolutely. That's huge. And Professor Kim noted that it's one thing to share any books with kids. It's another thing to share books of their choosing. If I'm interested in reptiles or amphibians or minerals, if I'm interested in history, you sharing some fiction with me is not necessarily going to do it for me. Alternatively, if I'm not interested at all in nonfiction and all you do is pelt me with nonfiction, that's similarly not going to work. So we give kids a mix of choices from which to select. And the research shows, not just ours but elsewhere, that this helps drive the reading achievement.
One thing that was recently announced was the so-called One Card Initiative, in which a single card is both the ID for the student in school or the employee, for that matter, and also serves as the card to use at the Kalamazoo Public Library. Why do you see this as an important initiative?
Well, first of all, the library is a jewel in the community, and we have a phenomenal partnership with KPL. Reading is huge. If there is one thing about school that is hugely important, it's that our kids read at grade level and that they read enormously. I tell kids that we don't need them to become smart. We need them to become smarter. They're already smart. They need to become smarter. And in order to become smarter, they have to read. Places and communities with the greatest numbers of books are libraries. They need to go to the library at least once a week, particularly in the summer. They need to check out books at least once a week. They need to read daily. What they read, particularly during the summer, is their business. That they read is our business. It's critical. And we need parents to hop aboard this literacy train. We need them to drive that reading with their children. They should be reading with their kids. Lift Up Through Literacy is a series of literacy partnerships that we have in our community, doing parent education and family literacy at community sites across the across Kalamazoo, in places like New Genesis or Stones Church, Mount Zion Baptist Church, First Baptist, and these are opportunities for parents to learn how to work with literacy with their children, reading with their children, having their children read to them, exploring what was read, probing to see that they understood what was in the text. This is all about expanding children's exposure, their background knowledge, their ability to connect to other topics. So we're trying to drive kids' background knowledge, trying to improve what they know and what they're able to go into other conversations and other books with.
Do you think that the One Card Initiative, speaks to perhaps some barriers that were in place to getting kids and parents to do that?
No doubt. The One Card Initiative, which will begin this fall, is an effort on the part of the schools and the library to share data about kids subject to the approval of our parents so that they can get library cards without having to go to the library and produce a gas bill or an electric bill or a mortgage of one sort or another. We provide basic information for the kids, again, subject to the approval of parents. All of our children in the district will be getting library cards as a result, with the exception, again, of those parents who may choose to opt their children out. We anticipate that thousands of children this fall will be getting library cards that don't have library cards. We've got this great program with the library where we take first graders to the library. We take all 1,000 first graders to the library three times each year, first to share with them how the library works, and the KPL gives them a temporary library card. They check out their first book in their lives in most cases. The second is for the purpose of taking the book back, seeing how you return the book, how you check out another book. And the third is for the purpose of learning about the summer library program. That's a great program. We love the first grade program, getting kids acculturated to the library at 6 years old. However, the library cards that are distributed are only temporary library cards. They're not permanent library cards. And the One Card program that we're discussing now is a program that is going to fill that gap, is actually going to make permanent these library cards moving forward, not the first grade library cards, but all library cards for the district. In addition, KPL has agreed to waive fines for our young people if they have them on a one-time basis only. So if a number of years ago, by some circumstance, you had something that wasn't returned to the library, you got a fine associated with it, KPL wants to wipe the slate clean and wants to start you fresh. Now, it's not going to do that in perpetuity, but it'll do that for the one time to get this program going. And again, we anticipate, when all is said and done, several thousand more library cards this fall than existed in the district beforehand.
In addition to all the things we've been talking about up until now, two of the schools in the KPS district are actually going to be starting much earlier than the rest in July, I believe. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So Washington Writers Academy and Woodward School for Technology and Research are both going to be starting July 23rd. They're going to have a constrained summer rather than the 81-day summer to which I'd referred earlier in our conversation. They're going to have a 38-day summer this summer. They'll leave school June 14th. They'll be back at school July 23rd. They will have a shorter summer and therefore a less precipitous summer slide, if any summer slide at all. This is really good news for the children and families who are in that, in one of those two schools. We still have a few slots available for those parents who have an interest in signing their children up. They could call Student Services at 337-0161, or they could call Student Services at 337-0161. I sound a little bit like a carnival barker, but nonetheless, it is important. It's a new program. Some people may be a little bit wary of new, but in this case, new is good, and it's exciting. You're not going to school more days during the year. You're not going to school more hours during the year. We'd like to be able to have more days in our school year. That's not something that at this point we can afford. What we can afford to do is to change the sequencing of the days and the structure of the days throughout the year, making a smaller summer and somewhat larger breaks sprinkled throughout the year as a result.
Now, these two schools were targeted by the state not so long ago for possible closure because of problems with the state anyway, felt with student achievement. Is this related to that?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. Were it not for student achievement, we wouldn't be doing this. If we felt our kids were all reading during the summer, we wouldn't be doing this. But we are taking a series of efforts to insert ourselves additionally into that out-of-school time. If you do the math, Andy, we have children 1,098 hours during the school year. But there are 8,760 hours in a year. So we have children for basically one-eighth of the year. We could benefit from another 20 days, another 30 days, another 40 days of instruction. We could also benefit from a more balanced calendar, that is, a calendar that had perhaps the same number of school days, if we weren't able to add days, but days that were cut up during the year with one very, very large break, typically in the summer, that we do now. So a lot of what we're attempting to do is based on the research of Richard Allington, who notes the tremendous decline in reading levels, particularly of working class and poor children during the summer. And what he's noted is that working class and poor children and middle class children grow at roughly the same rates in their reading levels during the school year, but that in the summer, middle-class children are more likely to be flat to increasing in their reading levels because they're more likely to be reading. Working-class and poor children more likely to be flat to declining because they're less likely to be reading. And so something like the summer slide reduction pilot at Washington and Woodward has as its impetus reducing the summer and reducing the amount of summer slide as a result. You slide less when you come back to school after a summer, however short or however long it may be. You will have suffered less decline, and because you will have suffered less decline, you need to spend fewer days to catch back up to where you were at the beginning of the school, at the end of the preceding school year.
I'm Andy Robbins. I've been speaking with Kalamazoo School Superintendent Michael Rice. You're listening to WMUK's West Southwest.
Listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Arlene McMichael. 2 years ago, Michigan passed a law requiring schools teach about genocide. How's that effort going? Corey Harbaugh, a member of the Governor's Council on Genocide and Holocaust Education, joins us today for an update. He'll be speaking in Kalamazoo on Saturday, May 26. Harbaugh is Director of Teaching and Learning at Fenville Public Schools in Allegan County. Welcome to WMUK.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be with you.
You're going to be a keynote speaker at an event Saturday at Kalamazoo College's Arcus Center for Social Justice Leadership, and it's going to be commemorating the 24th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide of the Tutsis.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about what educators now have to teach?
In the passing of Public Act 170, Michigan joined a short list of states in the country that mandates that in our education system, our students are going to learn about the Holocaust and genocide education. And in our mandate in Michigan, that means the Armenian genocide is required content. And so this Public Act establishes as required part of our curriculum that in order to go through our schools and to graduate, you have to spend some time learning about some of the most atrocious events in human history and what they mean historically, but also what they mean about being citizens as our kids graduate and leave Michigan schools and go out and become citizens in our state.
Is it specifically dealing with the Holocaust in Germany, or does it also require other genocides such as dealing with Rwanda?
So in the mandate, we are going to teach about genocide, but specific to the mandate, there are two historical examples of genocide that are mandated topics for this curriculum edition. And those are the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust that took place during the events of World War II or leading up to and during World War II, and then also the Armenian genocide that took place consistent with events leading into and around World War I. So those two historic events are the specific genocides that are covered. But with that, then, we're going to look at and put into the recommended materials and training that we study genocide as a concept and a historic pattern of events that repeats. So there's work by a gentleman named Dr. Stanton who has identified patterns of genocide. And when you look at genocide as a topic in and of itself, and then you apply what's been learned about genocide, it applies to what happened in Rwanda in leading into 1994 and the events of 94, which was the genocide against the Tutsis. But also when you look at current events or you look at other historic examples of genocide and mass atrocity, those patterns repeat.
You really have become quite the expert about the Holocaust. You serve as a U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum teacher fellow and a University of Southern California Shoah Foundation, I don't know if I'm saying that correct, teacher. More importantly, you've had chapters in books that teach educators about the Holocaust. But what people need to know is that long before you went into administration in the Fenville schools, you were a teacher. This is where your journey started in terms of teaching about the Holocaust. You were an English teacher.
That's right.
At Goebbels High School.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that journey, why you became so passionate about this.
Thank you for saying, most importantly, you were a teacher. Because of all of the list of credentials that I am proud of, being a teacher is the first and most important. When I was a teacher back more than 10 years ago, I was assigned to teach a Holocaust unit in an English class. And in delivering that unit, I learned that I didn't have enough historic and content knowledge to be able to do the topic justice. And so that got me asking questions about my own professional development and some professional reading I wanted to do. And I realized that a lot of the questions I had about the historic context for teaching about the Holocaust, many of the questions I had not yet been answered or at least hadn't been shared publicly. And so that began for me a process of asking questions, looking for those answers. And when those answers existed in community, whether it was professional development community or resources that were there, to pursue them. And where those questions didn't have answers, to try to answer them myself, which is how the research chapter came about that ended up in the book that you talked about. I wanted to know how effective teachers across the country were teaching about the Holocaust, the strategies they were using in the classroom, how they were assessing. And I surveyed teachers, more than 1,000 teachers, and I took the responses to questions and collected them in terms of research. That led me to a series of professional development opportunities. I started at the Olga Lennial Institute in New York City, which had a 10-day seminar for teachers. And it was really around teaching the issues of teaching Holocaust history, but also the issues that are wrapped around Holocaust education.
The full name of that group is the Olga Lennial Institute for Holocaust Studies and Human Rights in New York City.
That's right. And And that program has a yearly seminar for teachers from across the country. And the good people at TOLE realized that they can't bring every teacher in America to New York City for that seminar. So then they funded a series of satellite seminars across the country. And having been an alum of that program, I helped establish a similar program based on that model here in Michigan for teachers. And we run that program every July, and it's held at the Holocaust Memorial Center in Farmington Hills, Michigan. And what we do is we invite teachers from across Michigan to come to Farmington Hills for a week-long program.
One is coming up in July, and you are
right.
You are co-leading that.
That's correct.
You're listening to Corey Harbaugh on WMUK's West Southwest. Harbaugh is updating us on efforts in Michigan schools to teach about genocide, as required by law passed in 2016. He's a member of the Governor's Council on Genocide and Holocaust Education. You kind of hinted at it earlier, that there's lessons to be learned from studying these atrocities from years past. It's relevant today.
Absolutely. What I found when I was teaching, and this really began the journey, was that kids, 18-year-old kids, I was working with seniors, you know, they were going to graduate, and we were telling them things like, you know, you're going to go out and change the world. And what we realized is that the world in its history has examples of what can happen out there, and examples of that, like the Holocaust, contains some of the most atrocious and most important lessons we have to learn. But they also give us examples of what happens when humanity takes place, where a neighbor looks after a neighbor or somebody stands up to power. So most of Holocaust education is studying atrocity, but there are also examples of what it means to be an upstander and not a bystander. And we think that's really important education. 70 years after the Holocaust, a couple of years ago, you know, we found ourselves remembering 70 years back, but also looking around at examples of dehumanization that were taking place then and continue to take place. You know, a couple of days ago in the news, I read about a reference that had been made by a member of our current administration here in the United States, calling a certain population of individuals animals. And that's the kind of language that was used in 1994 when the genocide against the Tutsis took place. Tutsis were referred to as cockroaches and other kinds of vermin in public media. And then you go back to the years leading up to the Holocaust, often language that was dehumanizing was pointed at the Jewish population in Germany and across the Third Reich. Vermin, cockroaches, rats, disease, things like that. And so when you study the Holocaust, those lessons are still as relevant today, again, when you look at the patterns that repeat. So what I found was with those 18-year-olds, they were eager for, they were deeply connected to these historic lessons because they understand, and they understand the relevance and the connection to today.
So that's cause for concern when we begin to hear that type of language.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And what I love about teaching the Holocaust and other genocides to students is you teach them the history, you have them take a look at it, and they go, well, wait a minute, what's happening here in my neighborhood or in my town or in my country? Without having an agenda, without making it overtly political, because that's not our responsibility. It is our responsibility to get our kids to look at their world and to ask questions about it. And when you study history like the Armenian Genocide, like the Holocaust, those questions naturally come up to kids and they make those connections when they think about the topics.
When people begin to use this type of language against another group and it becomes kind of, I don't know, part of the public conversation, that's a gateway to what? What are you saying and what have you found?
So, and this isn't my work. This is the work of Dr. Stanton, who has published widely on stages of genocide. And one of those stages includes the process of dehumanization. In order for genocide or atrocity to take place in a society like Germany in the 1930s and 40s or anywhere in the world today, people have to be dehumanized. There has to be a target population that has been identified as less than or different than in dangerous ways. And that process of dehumanization, it has to take place in order for groups of people or a country to turn its laws or to turn neighbor against neighbor to target a population who has been dehumanized. So it's part of what happens. Some of the work that we've incorporated into our Governor's Council work comes around the idea that genocide happens in stages.
Do you discuss those stages in part of what you promote as best practices for teaching about genocide?
We do, absolutely.
What are some of the other stages?
So it starts with classification, where people have to be distinguished into us and them. And then one of those classifications of people is targeted. There's another stage is discrimination, and discrimination becomes legal or becomes common practice in that society. Dehumanization, then people are organized, according to Dr. Stanton, they're polarized. And then as events lead to genocide itself, there's preparation for genocide, there's persecution, and then those stages rise to physical violence. Interestingly, also, Stanton talks about the final stage being denial, and that's often the case where a society or a group of people will look back at the historic event and say it didn't happen or it didn't happen in that way. That's certainly a dynamic with the Armenian genocide. One of the really interesting things about the genocide against the Tutsis that we're commemorating here on May 26th is that in Rwanda, there has been incredible work that has taken place to try to deal with the fact that in that genocide, it was often neighbor as attacker and neighbor as victim. And how do you reconcile a country and communities and neighborhoods where that happened? And so in many ways, they've taken really great steps to work towards reconciliation instead of denial. Some inspiring work that comes out of Rwanda.
You were talking about what you try to have students understand is being what you called an upstander and not a bystander. Let's close on that. Talk more about that and how it applies to modern day.
What I hope every student gets a chance to do, every adult, every person gets a chance to do, is to listen to a survivor give his or her personal testimony. When you hear another person, you are moved by a human story of survival and often deep loss and personal and family and community rupture. I have never seen students not be affected by that. And when you look across the table or you look across the room at a person, you can no longer as easily stay silent or uninvolved when something is being directed, an act of violence or an act of hate or bigotry at somebody else. The goal of our K-12 education system should be, as much as anything else, to prepare citizens. And good citizens are citizens that take responsibility for their neighbor, for their town, their community, their state, their nation, their world. And to do that, you can't sit passively by when things are taking place around you and be inactive or be a bystander. Again, it's that human story. It's hearing testimony. It's being called to action. We know that we're preparing kids who have had a chance to solve algebraic equations or do chem labs or things like that. Public Act 170 says we also want kids who have been prepared by studying this history to see opportunities for them to get involved in their own lives and the lives of their neighbors when things are happening that should make them alarmed.
Mr. Harbaugh, good luck with your upcoming studying, learning, and teaching critical lessons in Holocaust education from July 9th through the 14th at the Holocaust Museum in Farmington Hills.
Thank you for your interest and your support. Our Summer Seminar for Teachers is a program of the Third Coast Writing Project at Western Michigan University, which is chaired by Jonathan Bush, professor of English at Western. And since our beginning in 2011, we've been a program of that. Of the Third Coast Writing Project. So teachers who take our program can earn graduate credit through Western, but what we also do is we use the methodology of the Writing Project as part of our teacher training methodology.
Corey Harbaugh is the keynote speaker for an event commemorating the 24th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide of the Tutsis, being held at Kalamazoo College's Arcus Center for Social Justice Leadership on Saturday, May 26. For more information and for a longer version of this interview, go online to WMUK.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.